This is Family Policy Matters. This program is produced by the North Carolina Family Policy Council, a pro-family research and education organization dedicated to strengthening and preserving the family. And now from the studio, here's John Rustin, president of the North Carolina Family Policy Council.
Thank you for joining us for Family Policy Matters. This week you will hear the second part of a powerful presentation on the fundamental importance of marriage that we began last week featuring noted scholar and writer Ryan Anderson. Ryan gave this speech at the North Carolina Family Policy Council's Major Speaker Series Dinner in April 2014. Ryan is the William E. Simon Fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., and he is the editor of the journal Public Discourse. Ryan is one of the most articulate and winsome defenders of traditional marriage in our nation today. In part two, Ryan continues his discussion about the consequences of redefining marriage and encourages traditional marriage supporters to stay engaged in the battle for marriage. We hope you enjoy it. Now to Ryan Anderson.
And so the second answer to the question of, you know, what are the consequences of redefining marriage? The first is that you eliminate this ideal, you eliminate the teaching function of the law that a child deserves a mother and a father. The second is that there won't be a stopping point, that redefining marriage is a dissolvent. It will dissolve the institution of marriage into simple contract law, and that consenting adults of whatever size or shape should be able to form marriages of whatever size or shape. It just dissolves the marriage institution. The last consequence has to do with religious liberty. And this is the one that we're actually experiencing first. This is the one that we already have victims of. But I mention it last because I think these first two are actually the more important from a health of marriage perspective. That if you care about the future of marriage, those first two consequences I mentioned are really where we should be focusing. But this last consequence is the one that we're experiencing now. And I'll mention, you know, first I'll mention the lawsuit that was filed. The UCC Church was saying that it violates their free exercise of religion to define marriage as the union of a man and a woman. And then they add in that there's a North Carolina statute that says you can't officiate at a wedding unless there's a marriage license. And they actually misread that statute. It says if you're going to be officiating at a state-recognized marriage, you have to actually have the marriage license, and that you can't say by the power vested in me by the state of North Carolina, I now declare you husband and wife if the couple hasn't presented you with the license and you fill it out. So it's more of a paperwork regulation. But it said nothing about whether or not a clergy could say by the power vested in me by the United Church of Christ, I now declare you husband and wife. The North Carolina Marriage Amendment is very clear. The first sentence says marriage shall be defined as a union of a man and a woman. Second sentence says nothing in this should prohibit private contracts from being formed or enforced by law. And so it said that other types of unions are free to be formed, they're free to be recognized under contract law, and churches will be free to recognize those. So in the state of North Carolina, two people of the same sex can live with each other, they can love each other. They can go to a progressive church and have a wedding ceremony. They can work for a liberal business and receive benefits if the church chooses to and if the business chooses to. But what's at stake with the redefinition of marriage is, will the government redefine marriage and then tell every citizen that they have to treat a same-sex couple as if it's a marital relationship? Tell every religious community that it has to treat a same-sex relationship as if it's a marriage. Maybe not inside the four walls of the chapel itself, but we know how they've been treating Hobby Lobby and how they've been treating the Little Sisters of the Poor and how they've been treating Notre Dame and how they've been treating Wheaton College when it comes to religious liberty. Those groups don't have religious liberty under the Obamacare mandate. So they've exempted houses of worship, but they haven't exempted religious charities or religious universities or businesses that are run by religious individuals. And so the question of religious liberty is, will the state redefine marriage and then coerce the people in this room into treating a same-sex relationship as if it's a marriage, even when doing so would violate your religious beliefs? And the most well-known case of this is the case of Elaine Photography. Elaine's an evangelical Christian who lives in New Mexico. She runs a photography company called Elaine Photography. And in 2006, she was asked by a same-sex couple to be the wedding photographer. She politely declined, saying, "I believe marriage is the union of a man and a woman." The couple was able to find another photographer in town to do their wedding photos. The other photographer actually charged them less than what Elaine normally charges. It's not as if conservative Christians have a monopoly on the wedding photography business. But the couple sued her anyway. And the New Mexico Commission on Human Rights sided with the couple and against Elaine in 2008. And they ordered her to pay almost $7,000 in fines. They said she had violated the human rights of the same-sex couple. She then appealed this all the way up to the New Mexico State Supreme Court, and they agreed with the lower court. And in one of the concurring opinions, the judge wrote that the price of citizenship is that Elaine has to take these photos. And when I got to that, I thought he was going to say that the price of citizenship is that the same-sex couple should go to a different photographer. That in the American system of live and let live, you don't force someone else to violate their conscience. You don't force someone else to be your wedding photographer. That part of free contracts, free markets, free association, and the free exercise of religion is that we can each lead our lives in accordance with our beliefs. The same-sex couple is free to live and to love how they want to, but the evangelical should be free to run her photography business how she wants to. And the government said no. We've also seen that Christian adoption agencies in Massachusetts and Illinois and in Washington, D.C., have been forced out of the adoption and foster care space because they wanted to find homes with married moms and dads for the children in their care. But the government said that's discriminating. You're discriminating against the same-sex couple. And unless you treat the married same-sex couple on an equal footing as you do the married mother and father, we won't give you an adoption agency license. And it's illegal to run an adoption agency without an adoption license. And so these organizations were forced out of that space. This does nothing to help orphans. This does nothing to help children. It just scores points for political correctness. It's a vindictive measure to punish those who hold a different belief. And the reason I had mentioned earlier Hobby Lobby and Notre Dame and Wheaton and the Little Sisters of the Poor is just to see how this current administration understands religious freedom. They have actually argued in court that once you step out into the marketplace, you don't have First Amendment rights, at least not First Amendment free exercise of religion rights. And so they said, yes, you know, the pastor inside the four walls of his chapel, he has religious liberty protections. But the Little Sisters of the Poor, a group of Catholic nuns who take care of the elderly, they have to abide by the HHS Obamacare mandate. Hobby Lobby, an arts and crafts store run by the Green family, an evangelical family, they have to abide by the HHS mandate. What does the HHS mandate do? In the case of the Little Sisters of the Poor, they're Catholic, they're against contraception, and they're against abortion. The Green family, they're evangelical, they're just against abortion. And four of the drugs that the Obama administration mandates have an FDA label that says they can cause an abortion. So Hobby Lobby says, we don't want to be forced to pay for pills that can kill. And the government has said, sorry, you don't have religious liberty rights. You have to abide by the law or you will face crippling fines. That's how the government, the current administration at least, understands religious liberty. And that's what's in the future for those who continue to believe the truth about marriage if the left gets their way. Laws will be used to coerce citizens, their charitable institutions, and their businesses into facilitating and celebrating same-sex unions as marriages, or pay fines, or be forced out of business. But I'll close with this. 41 years ago, people told the pro-lifers that they were on the wrong side of history. They told the pro-lifers that all of the young people were in favor of abortion, and that the only pro-lifers that'll be left a generation from now will be the elderly in nursing homes and the Pope in Rome. That's what the future held. And at the time, we saw prominent public officials evolved on the question of abortion. Pro-lifers, people like Ted Kennedy and Bill Clinton and Al Gore and Jesse Jackson, who were all pro-life, evolved and became pro-choice. We saw that public opinion shifted to nearly 2-1, 67% pro-choice and only 33% pro-life. The reason that I mentioned 41 years ago is that that's right after the Roe v. Wade decision. So the court strikes down life laws, abortion laws in all 50 states, and then the law taught something. It taught that abortion was a constitutional right. It's not really a constitutional right. There's nothing in the actual Constitution that protects a right to choose to kill. But that's what a new generation of young people was hearing from the court. And that's why public opinion shifted. It's why politicians evolved. And it would have been really easy for pro-lifers 41 years ago to say, oh, we're on the wrong side of history. We might as well give up. But they didn't. And now today, my generation is more pro-life than my parents' generation. You can clap. It's easy for my generation to be pro-life precisely because of the hard work that my parents' generation did. That there were people who 40 years ago formed the pro-life organizations. National Right to Life, Americans United for Life, the Susan B. Anthony List, one of the co-sponsors for tonight's dinner. Students for Life of America, one of the campus pro-life groups. The Silent No More campaign. Feminists for Life. There were pro-life academics who wrote the books and the law review articles about why Roe was bad constitutional law. They did the scientific articles about why the unborn child's not a clump of cells, but it's a human being. They did the moral philosophy arguments for why the unborn child has a right to life. And then you had politicians who eventually found their courage. You have someone like President Ronald Reagan, the only sitting president to write a book titled Abortion and the Conscience of a Nation. President Reagan uses the bully pulpit to recall America to its founding principle of there being a natural right to life. He has Ed Meese installed as Attorney General, who then helps make sure our laws are doing what they can to protect the unborn, to make sure we get good pro-life justices on the Supreme Court. We have people like Henry Hyde come up with the Hyde Amendment that prohibits federal funding from paying for abortion. These are all the sorts of activities that took place in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s that now makes it easy for me to be a pro-lifer. And these are the sorts of activities that we now have to do on the marriage issue. And it can't just be law and policy. It has to also be culture. And so one thing that I think we have to wrestle with is, what is the alternative to TV shows that glamorize the redefinition of marriage or that glamorize teenage sexual activity in general? That's something I think we're still wrestling with, is what is the response to Hollywood? Hollywood has done so much to undermine the values that the people in this room stand for. And so it has to be a response that has the church engaged, that has Hollywood and culture engaged, but that also has the law and public policy engaged, because the law will teach. And it'll either teach the truth or it'll teach a lie. And the question of what the law will do, what the culture will do, what the church will do, is ultimately something that will depend on what we will do. Ultimately, that's the only thing we have direct control over. We don't have control over what the governor will do, what the court will do, what the president will do. We each have control over what we will do. And that's why it's great to see so many people here tonight, so many people lending their support for what the North Carolina Family Policy Council is doing, and doing what each of us can do in our own vocations. We each have a role to play. And I thank you for playing that role.
You have been listening to select portions of Ryan Anderson's April 2014 speech on the fundamental nature and importance of marriage, which was presented at the North Carolina Family Policy Council's Major Speakers Series dinner in Raleigh. You can view a video of Ryan's full speech on the North Carolina Family Policy Council website at ncfamily.org. Again, that address is ncfamily.org. Thanks so much for listening.
Family Policy Matters is an information and analysis feature of the North Carolina Family Policy Council. Join us weekly for discussion on policy issues affecting the family. If you have questions or comments, please contact us at 919-807-0800 or visit our website at ncfamily.org.